Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
It seemed inevitable, once I decided to write a book on history's most seismic first nights, that my first port of call should be Dublin. Few cities have packed in as many premieres of mayhem and magic as Dublin, and few countries have funnelled their tensions and rages through the theatre as greatly as Ireland. Maud Gonne's memorable entrance in a doorway in Yeats and Lady Gregory's Kathleen na Hoolan is one of the all-time first night moments. The argument and dreams of its authors, the hunger and need of its audience, and the expressive capacity of a charismatic figure all coming together in one stark image. The first Abbey was a cockpit of fantastic imagining and bitter truth, and within its wooden clatter were played out the passions of the emerging nation-state. Here, Playboy, fireworked into life, roared along by a brawl confected by Yeats, who had invited a group of drunken Trinity students along to make mischief. Yeats was at the centre again 15 years later, when Plough and the Stars opened, and he stood on stage and barked at a seething mob, "You have disgraced yourselves again." Yeats could be said to be a connoisseur of the riotous first night, having attended the legendary brouhaha of Alfred Jarry's Ouvrage in Paris. He clearly had a taste for chaos. My initial weekend of research in Dublin was spent in discussion with a number of academics talking about why the city had a propensity for concocting the broth that boils over and spills out onto the grate. My last conversation was with the theatre scholar Chris Marash. At the end of our delightful chat in the National Library, he pressed into my hands his book, A History of Irish Theatre. I read it and discovered that on Kathleen and the Playboy and the Plough, he had got there first and unimprovably. His overall narrative studded with short chapters summoning up the excitement and the drama of each first night. I was, in literary terms, gazumped. Happily, he had left Handel's Messiah, a first night which survives into my book, or rather a first midday, since the oratorio began in Fishamble Street at 12, to leave the audience time for a gargantuan Augustan supper afterwards. 900 folk crammed into the great music hall, a number only possible after an advertisement was published requesting the ladies to appear without their hoops and the gentlemen without their swords, a request which throws up any number of Freudian interpretations. In discussing Dublin's propensity for the volcanic premiere, each academic offered a different historical or linguistic or sociological theory, all brilliant and acute. But I kept being brought back to an observation I had once heard. By a stroke of immense good fortune, when I was young, I acquired an extra mother and father in Maeve Binchy and Gordon Snell. They were our Valverwandtschaft, as the Germans phrase it, in one of their encompassing compound words. Chosen family, to go alongside given family. Maeve used to define one of the characteristics of Dublin and its population as always being on the verge. Sometimes she felt everyone she met was on the verge. Whether of falling in love or of marital breakup, of going down with something nasty or rising back up to glorious health, of a tremendous breakthrough or a calamitous collapse, whichever didn't matter much. What mattered was that they were on a precipice with something huge about to happen. A whole city on the verge. Of course, there are few moments we manufacture for ourselves more precipitously on the verge than a world premiere. The adrenaline beforehand pumping through artists and spectators, the focus which the attention of so many sharpens, the terror of failure or the exhilaration of success swimming before everyone's eyes, all these factors combine to pump electricity into the air around you. Maybe there's just a natural fit between the temperament of Dublin and the natural temperament of these nights. Maybe they heighten each other to fresh cliff heights of on the verge. My mind passed over the many first nights I had attended and been involved with in Ireland. The vividness of Declan Hughes's Digging for Fire in The Project, which rampantly proclaimed a new, sexy and young Ireland shucking off the griefs and sorrows of the past. Our transfer of Billy Roach's Wexford trilogy to the opera house of his hometown, where it seemed the entire population had crammed themselves into the beautiful auditorium to witness themselves being related and understood. and the mesmeric powers of Sebastian Barry's White Woman Street, which we transferred to the Peacock, where the actors' grizzled faces and Sebastian's weather-beaten words were enough to transport the audience to a Wild West landscape, a suspension of disbelief which somehow survived one entire bit of scenery falling over. And I remembered the first night of my production of Philadelphia, Here I Come in the Gaiety in 2010. An encounter backstage between Maeve and Brian Friel came sharply to mind. Down a long corridor they inched towards each other, Maeve stooping and Brian shuffling. As they approached one another, they pulled themselves a little upright. "We're doing all right, aren't we, Brian?" said Maeve cheerily. "Maeve, we're both..." and then an extremely rude word, rasped Brian. It would be hard to imagine a better summary of their different world views. And after every first night of exemplary exhilaration, much drinking in the bar, then mayhem in the Trocadero restaurant, then retiring to some unfortunate's home, then all spilling out at dawn to dissipate energy and excitement in lonely walks into a sea breeze. There are few places that know how to engender and enjoy a memorable first night like Dublin.
For many people, mention of the word fungus or mushroom conjures up an image either of something poisonous or mind-altering. We all remember the perspective-modifying power of the mushroom Alice eats in Wonderland, and children will certainly have been told that the fungi they encounter in the wild are most likely deadly and to be avoided. In our local parks, you'll often come across bountiful flushes of fungi having been kicked and stamped to mush by ill-informed walkers. On a very basic level, fungi exist in a class of their own, being neither animal nor plant, and are in fact often referred to as the third kingdom. They don't have the capacity to photosynthesize, and so they'll typically form what's known as mycorrhizal relationships within the root networks of trees and plants, wherein a symbiotic trade-off is established. In this relationship, the fungi are allowed access to the essential building blocks necessary for their growth, such as carbon, in return for providing phosphorus to the tree or plant, or even acting as bodyguard against pests and other parasitic fungi. My own relationship with fungi began when I was a child, growing up in Offaly, when my siblings and I would forage for field mushrooms. I remember bringing bagfuls home. We'd pare the stalks and clean any grass or soil from the caps to ready them for the pan, where they'd either be sautéed in butter or stewed in milk. I still remember the light brown juice that soaked into our potatoes and its distinctive savoury taste. Finding puffballs was a particular joy, given their resemblance to bright white footballs sitting in the grass. Sliced, fried, in butter with a dash of salt and a twist of pepper, these added another dimension to the textures and flavours of our foraging. Of course, in those days, we didn't use the word forage, a term which has been adopted by suburban mushroom enthusiasts, who often go on guided foraging tours with an experienced mushroom hunter. We simply went mushroom picking. A word of warning, though. Attending one or two foraging sessions doesn't make you an expert, and you should never eat fungi without being absolutely certain as to their edibility. Even then, there are mushrooms that could be consumed without consequence for some while causing stomach upset in others. I myself, though no expert, have saved the odd amateur forager an upset tummy or worse by pointing out some telltale features on the mushroom in their basket. In worst case scenarios, eating the wrong mushroom, such as the aptly named death cap, will result in death. The amateur mycologist should gradually build up their knowledge through field trips, reading, and tech tools such as ID apps. The simple phrase, Never munch on a hunch sums it up nicely. My mushroom picking days ended when I left home for university. Living in the city, my confidence in ascertaining which mushrooms were edible waned to the extent that I will not now eat a wild mushroom. But my interest in fungi was reawakened during the rolling COVID lockdowns, when I noticed several species of mushroom growing on the grass verges near where I lived, and bought a guide by the renowned mycologist Roger Phillips. I learned how to make spore prints of those mushrooms I couldn't readily identify by eye, and use their colour along with other characteristics such as cap shape, gill type and stipe texture to correctly identify numerous species that were growing within my 2 kilometre walking range. Once the lockdowns lifted, I ventured further afield and began to explore the woodlands in the hills around Dublin and Wicklow. A renewed connection with the natural world has opened up for me through my reawakened interest in fungi. Since then, I've found rare species which I never knew existed, such as lilac coral and golden bootleg. Just last year, I found a group of fly agaric, the classic red mushroom with white spots often seen in fairy tale illustrations, or to give them their Latin name, Amanita muscaria. The only downside to amateur mycology that I can think of is the occasional opprobrium heaped upon me by my family as I interrupt yet another walk to duck into a hedgerow or rifle through some woodland detritus in search of treasure. But I don't think they mean it, because my wife now openly delights in being the first to find scarlet elf cups in the mosses of early spring.
Growing up in communist Hungary in the 1980s, I used to watch the television news with my father. I remember well seeing his face tighten as he watched footage of a Hungarian village in Romania being flooded to create a reservoir on the orders of the autocratic president Ceausescu, so that only a church steeple and the tops of the tallest trees were visible. A quiet and peaceful man, my father didn't comment, but to this day I can't forget the pain and incredulity on his face. That village was in a region which had previously been part of Hungary, Transylvania, a place most people in the West associate with Dracula. Transylvania has been on my bucket list ever since I first learned about the region from my parents, but I didn't hear much about it in school. The 1920 Treaty of Trianon, which resulted in Hungary losing 2/3 of its territory, including Transylvania, was not discussed in depth. It was a wound not to be opened. Over 100 years ago, when Ireland was grappling with political upheaval during her fight for independence, Hungary was forced to sign away her own on a painful scale. The brutal truncation of Old Hungary was considered to be the necessary price for establishing peace in Europe after World War I. Neighboring nations benefited hugely from a transfer of Hungarian lands, enormously rich in natural resources. Overnight, 3.3 million Hungarians suddenly found themselves floundering outside their mother country, living under a foreign government. Many were oppressed for practicing their own culture and speaking their own language. During the treaty negotiations, the Hungarian delegation was given to understand that the newly imposed borders would be a temporary measure only, and that the original borders could be restored. This never happened. Today, over a century on, the borders established by Trianon still stand, along with the transgenerational trauma caused by this tragic dictate. This summer, in the company of friends, I was privileged to travel to Transylvania. On the third day of our visit, we reached a huge lake set in a stunningly beautiful valley surrounded by rolling hills and pastures. We took a tour, and I was amazed to discover that this was the site of a flooded village, just like the one my father and I had seen on television almost 40 years before. Our tour guide told us the story behind the lake, which was actually a reservoir, and the village of Bözödújfalu. Following a bad storm in the 1970s, floodwaters had caused much damage to the area. As a consequence, Ceausescu's government decided to construct a huge dam. There was just one problem with this plan. Flooding the valley would wipe out the village of Bözödújfalu and its people, who had been settled there since the 1500s. According to a 1910 census, taken just before the Treaty of Trianon, of the 679 inhabitants, all but one had Hungarian as their mother tongue. The villagers practiced six different religions: Roman Catholic, Greek Catholic, Unitarian, Israelite, Reformed, and Greek Orthodox, and lived together for centuries in peace and harmony. It wasn't until 1988 that Ceausescu officially announced a grand plan under the title Rural Systematization Program. Local people took the scheme simply for what it was: village destruction. Under this scheme, almost 4,000 Hungarian and Romanian villages were to be vacated, the most misfortunate ones were even to be flooded, and the inhabitants to be removed to urban areas. The construction of the dam and the flooding of Bözödújfalu proceeded and was completed in 1988. The villagers found themselves transferred from their pastoral riverside homesteads to prefabricated concrete dwellings in an urban setting. In a single stroke, the rich, diverse community of Bözödújfalu was destroyed. One year later, the Ceausescu regime was overthrown. Today, the flooded valley has taken on a new life. Tiny holiday homes sit along the lake shore, each with its own pier. People now visit here to bathe, fish, and go boating, many oblivious to the tragic beginnings of the lake. A solitary, reconstructed steeple rising from the water, and dark, weather-beaten tree trunks bear poignant testimony to a village and its former inhabitants. In a trip that lasted 7 days, not once did the blood-stained legend of Count Dracula get a mention. Even though our tour to Transylvania had taken us 500 kilometers beyond the Hungarian border, the look of the houses, the shapes of the haystacks, the language spoken, and above all the warmth of its people made us feel as if we had never left home.
Some of my memories of the lobby bar in Cork are hazy now. What I remember comes in snatches, the painstakingly put together collages of photographs hanging on the yellow walls, the narrow stairs at the back of the bar, which led to the venue on the first floor, and the energy of the queues that would form on it before each show. The view upstairs, out the tall windows, to the city and the buildings beyond. I started going to gigs in the lobby just before I started college in UCC, at the turn of the millennium. As a music-loving teenager, I'd heard tales about this brilliant venue on a corner across from the City Hall. It was the kind of place that attracted well-known names like Christy Moore and Will Oldham, as well as local stalwarts like John Spillane and Sinead Lohan, and up-and-comers from home and abroad. It was the kind of place I needed to go to. The venue ended up being one of my music teachers, introducing me to another brilliant artist each time I visited. Even if I didn't get to go to a gig, just seeing the band's name on a poster was enough to pique my curiosity about new music. We were lucky, those of us who went to the lobby, although how lucky only became obvious after it closed. The Irish music scene was going through an intense singer-songwriter phase when I was at the height of my lobby-going days. So I got to see people like Damien Rice play their first gigs at the venue. One of my favourite musicians at that time was the American singer, Elliott Smith. I loved how his music had a sense of fragility to it. He wrote shimmering pop songs that could break your heart. His voice was tender and his melodies sugary sweet, but he was never afraid to sing about the dark sides of life. I played his albums until I knew every note and every drumbeat by heart. He had never played a gig in Cork, though when I was in secondary school, he'd played in Dublin. Sadly, no amount of asking would get me the parental permission I needed to go see him. So I entertained dreams instead of one day seeing his name on a poster with "Live at the Lobby Bar" written under it. On the 21st of October 2003, Elliott Smith died tragically in the US. As a heartbroken fan, in the months that followed, I wanted to do something to remember him by. So, although I felt a bit of an imposter, I eventually decided to put on a gig in tribute to him on the anniversary of his death in the lobby bar. Between college lectures, I'd go to the computer lab in UCC to send emails to musicians from Cork and beyond, asking them if they'd like to play the Elliott Smith tribute night. I had no budget and had never booked a gig before, but people said yes. The reason why people loved performing at the lobby was obvious. It was the ultimate intimate venue. The musicians stood on a small, curved stage in the corner of the room, inches from the audience. Behind them were large windows overlooking Union Quay, beyond which you could see the moon glint off the River Lee as it passed by in the night. To sit on a stool at one of the round tables and absorb the music was as great a treat as anything. As the day of the Elliott Smith tribute gig dawned in October 2004, heavy rain began to fall on Cork. The worst flooding in years was soon to arrive in a deluge onto the city centre, and the lobby was right next to Parnell Bridge, just feet from the River Lee. I was away from the city centre in UCC all day, relying on phone calls and hourly radio updates about the rising tide. As the afternoon came, I heard that the water level had reached over 3 feet high on the South Mall, which was just across the bridge from the lobby. I went home from college preparing for the worst. Because this was in the days before iPhones and Twitter, I was still in the dark about what was actually happening at the venue. I pictured musicians stuck in cars and buses, unable to make it to the city centre. In my mind, the lobby was surrounded by water and no one would make it through the door. Surely, I thought, the tribute gig would have to be cancelled. Then, an hour or so before the doors were to open, I got a phone call from a friend. "Come in, Aoife." Through some sort of strange luck, the lobby bar stood dry. The venue had stayed open and people were starting to turn up, ignoring the warnings to stay out of the city. The gig was still on. Despite it all, 60 people braved it out to hear the musicians pay tribute to Elliott Smith that soaking wet night, some who travelled all the way down to Cork from Northern Ireland. It showed me what people are willing to do for the sake of the music they love. The lobby bar closed in 2005, 17 years after its first gig. I'd managed to get there just a handful of years before it shut its doors. On the night of the Elliott Smith tribute, I headed home right after the musicians finished up. Overwhelmed as I was with how it had gone, it never occurred to me to stay, to soak up the atmosphere after such a precious gig. I didn't even take one photograph. I still think about that night. I imagine the moonlight shining on the swelling Lee, which had overspilled onto the streets. The sharing of memories of a musician tragically gone. The pints supped and glasses clinked. The new friendships made. I picture these moments in my mind as though I'd stayed for the whole thing. It amazes me now that, despite everything, despite the biblical weather and the venue's proximity to the rising flood, by some miracle the event came together. Perhaps it was down to, as the musician John Spillane would put it in his song about the treasured spot, the magic of nights in the lobby bar.
Drink up, baby, stay up all night with the things you could do. You won't, but you might. The potential you'll be that you'll never see. The promises you'll...
When I think back to the summer of 2015 and my last visit to Brian Friel in Greencastle, one memory stands out. Him showing me the Anthony Palliser portrait that now hangs over the entrance to the Brian Friel Theatre at Queen's University Belfast, where I work as a drama lecturer. The Abbey has one, the Gate has one, the Lyric has one, so I think Queen's should have one too, he said. And I was cast back to that convivial evening 6 years before, when a proud assembly of academics and artists had gathered to formally name the theatre in his honour. Seamus Heaney paid tribute to his old friend, and Friel himself declared that after a lifetime of paying little heed to the nice things people said about him, at the age of 80 he had decided to embrace it all with alacrity. So now his portrait sits in pride of place in the foyer of the theatre his daughter Judy told me he liked to call his own. A guardian angel, watching over all the students below, his expression at once thoughtful and demanding, which seems appropriate, for he was ever rigorous in his approach to his own craft. Famously reticent when asked to speak about his work, one phrase stands out from the collection of articles and interviews assembled by Christopher Murray for his 70th birthday. "The play," he said, "arises from its form." And that for me is what most characterised the way his work progressed, each play testing some new theatrical hypothesis. When Gareth O'Donnell, the protagonist of Philadelphia Here I Come, made his first appearance in Dublin's Gaiety Theatre in 1964, accompanied by another actor playing his private self, it was, as the director Conall Morrison has put it, the equivalent of splitting the theatrical atom. It released previously unimaginable energy onto the Irish stage, and it was only the beginning of Friel's seemingly endless capacity for radical innovation. The narrators in Winners, eerily foreshadowing the fate of Joe and Mag as they plan their future together on the last day of their lives. The Brechtian framing of the naturalistic world of the three refugees in Derry's Guildhall in Freedom of the City. The Chekhovian homage of Aristocrats, the theatrical sleight of hand that allows the audience to hear two languages in translations. With each device, Friel challenges assumptions about his dramaturgical style. If endless innovation was the hallmark of his stagecraft, the idea that there is no such thing as absolute truth is, for me, at the heart of Friel's drama. As topical as this seems in this brave new world of fake news and alternative facts, Friel was engaging with the subjective nature of experience from early in his writing career. Gar's vivid childhood memory of going fishing with his father in a blue boat is cruelly debunked. Casimir's cherished family mythology in Aristocrats becomes discredited. And this theme reaches its most developed form with Faith Healer, in which three accounts of the same events reveal subtle yet significant discrepancies. But the critical reception of translations gave Friel pause for thought. Although he protested that it was fundamentally a play about language, it was interpreted by some of the English press as political propaganda. Friel was no stranger to such charges. Freedom of the City, itself an exploration of competing versions of the truth, had been accused of Republican bias. When Making History finally appeared in 1988, it met the ambiguous nature of truth head-on, with Hugh O'Neill expressing his deep suspicion of the written historical record. One of the great ironies of Friel's later work is his growing doubt as a master wordsmith in the reliability of words. In the marvellous final speech of Dancing at Lunasa, he imagines a mode of performance in which words were no longer necessary. And Friel was to take this suspicion of language even further in one of his later plays. In performances, actors representing the ghost of the Czech composer Janáček and a young PhD student share the stage with the musicians of a string quartet. The student is researching Janáček's life, including the intimate letters he wrote to the married woman with whom he was infatuated. And the composer's ghost is not best pleased. "Why not let the music do the talking?" Janáček protests. It is a feeling undoubtedly close to Friel's own heart, the desire to let his work speak for itself. In the souvenir booklet published to coincide with a festival marking his 70th birthday, Friel wrote about the mythical Russian city of Kitej. Whenever it sensed that marauders were approaching, it encased itself in a mist. But its church bell never stopped ringing. In a sentiment that will be echoed by members of many of his audiences, for Friel, the true gift of theatre is the ringing bell which reverberates quietly and persistently in the head long after the curtain has gone down.
Two words for Munkon. Cúan, cúan. The last two words you would write to me. Unaware as I was that you were so ill, I reached out to forage your store of phrases, garner from your knowledge of the right word, dip into the well of your deep-rooted Tishkent. Though you told me you weren't capable to advise all who beseech you for words, you dug deep and followed up with just two. Cúan, cúan. Cúan, cúan. Safe harbour. It never dawned on me that you were running out of strength, that you might have had to reel through a fog of pain to fish for the words that today I return to you in a bianacht. Ek breath buiachas, for your magnificent, curious mind, your generous spirit, your sensitive, ancient soul. To the very aron agus im of your open heart, your unique monkonness. May you journey now to your own cúan cúan.
On this morning's Sunday Miscellany, we heard Memorable First Nights in Dublin by Dominic Drumgooley. Fantastic Fungi was by Adam Trodd. Travels in Transylvania by Bernadette Buda. Magic Nights in the Lobby Bar was by Aoife Barry. Splitting the Theatrical Adam, that was David Grant. And finally, Two Words for Munkon, a poem for the late much-missed Munkon McGann by Noel Linsky. Yeshte Greva Anam. The music this morning, Everything That Rises by The Stunning, featuring Camilo Sullivan. Cachalón an Sliabhe by Seamus and Cuiva. Early Hungarian Dances Fourth Movement, that was by Ferenc Furkos. Breaking Bars by Elliot Smith. And finally, Nocturne in No. 1 in E-flat Major by John Field. And that was played by Elizabeth Joy Rowe. And our selection this morning marks two events that have been taking place this weekend. The Echoes Festival, celebrating Maeve Binchy and Irish writers in Dalkey, County Dublin, and the inaugural launch of the Brian Friel Centre in Glenties, County Donegal. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer, Sarah Binchy. You can listen back to the programme on the RTE Radio app, on the programme website, or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.